MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today on Spartan Podcast. Here's an update from President Simon on MSU's Facility for Rare Isotope Beams Project, FRIB.
Well, it's unfortunate that the project is making such good scientific and management progress at a time when Congress is embroiled in budget reduction conversations and that the role of science is in question. We believe that FRIB as a project shows what's best about big science. It is a partnership that builds on an enormous amount of infrastructure already in place at Michigan State University. It represents a partnership with the state. The other thing that's really important, I think, about this project is that its cost structures are very effective given big science. We are now moving forward with a president's budget request that includes $22 million in FY13 for FRIB instead of the projected $50 million that we have redone, but the very complex and integrated budgeting for the project, assuming that $22 million. What it does is it lengthens the time in which the project can be completed, but ironically, it also raises the cost of the project. So since the project, we believe, is going to be ready to go after the CD23A review in April, it's one of those things where by delaying, you incur much more cost for a project than if you could move it forward, particularly in this construction environment. We've gone through an enormous number of reviews with FRIB. We have adopted the processes of the Department of Energy and believe we have adopted their entire sort of management structure that would be typical for their bigger laboratories, even though this is a different kind of agreement. And we've used the flexibility of the agreement model to help to reduce and manage the cost of the project. We had a review that has just recently been completed. That was a set of people who drilled down through all this massive amount of data and information to see if the cost estimates as well as the science were what we said they were. And the team deserves enormous amounts of credit because they got this new funding profile only 2 weeks before that review. And you can't imagine how that rippled through thousands of spreadsheets and calculations. But out of this review, which is one that is, quote, I'm responsible for being sure that it occurs, but it is staffed by people identified by the Department of Energy, not by me, that we came through with enormously positive recommendations on the science as well as the management, and that review said we were ready for CD23A. The final part of this process in order to get over that hump is a review that occurs in late April. But that time frame gives us a chance to clean up some of the inconsistencies that emerge with trying to redo all of the project numbers within a two-week time frame under the new funding profile that reflects the president's recommendations. We're using as much, you know, we want to argue as much as possible that we're ready for CD23A. I think the review will show that the department, we hope, will go ahead with signing that document, and that we continue to argue for more funding because it's really great for the country because it makes the project cheaper. And it's a well-managed project. It's the right kind of project for big science. It also has national security implications that are not what we would do, but what we can do in partnership with people who hold classified information on behalf of the United States government in other laboratories. So it has really critical elements for our national security, and it's a great bargain for the kind of science we're going to do. And the longer we sort of perpetuate this sort of funding process, the more it's going to cost. And that's exactly what the public shouldn't want out of big science. They should want efficiently managed projects, good value for their money, money that's spent in the United States, and a chance to really be competitive. And I think EFRIP represents all of those kinds of things.
Here's MSU President Simon's latest thinking on state funding for higher education in Michigan.
Well, I think that what the challenge is that if you're going to constrain tuition and you don't want universities to continue to atrophy, then you've got to get numbers that permit people to have inflationary increases. And that's not what was recommended, at least in the first pass of all of this, including the governor's recommendation about the money would be non-recurring in the base after 10 years of significant reductions. I think that the BLM's approach of outcomes is, among all the alternatives, probably a good one. It's interesting that the Senate, in taking those alternatives, picked up a model of the governor and actually assigned weights to each of the variables when a BLM intended it to be a composite score. So if you're high on one and low on another, you could still recognize a composite score and you weren't subjected to the game playing that went with giving more money to one column than another, because that gives an impression that you're sort of doing the conclusion and backing in, because it makes a significant amount of difference how much money is assigned to each column, because each institution is different in each column. And so there's a little bit of torquing there. We'll see what the House does. This whole tuition restraint thing has a national concern about cost, but cost is related to support, public support for education. So we have to sort of work through these and see what happens. The other thing about most of these formulas and approaches is that it really values, in a financial sense, institutions that get more and more out-of-state students, because you simply get the revenue from those students. And one of the reasons that Michigan State is near or at the bottom of the Big Ten in terms of dollars to spend per student in a combination of appropriation and tuition is because we have 80% in-state students, and we take a large number of transfer students. Almost all of them come from Michigan institutions. So it's interesting how that perverse element of all of this, and it's easier for an institution with lots of out-of-state students to hold in-state tuition down because that's all that's constrained. So when you're sitting at 20% and some other peers are sitting at 40%, it's easier for them to play the tuition game but still have lots more money to spend. And it seems unfair, and I think it's one of those moral dilemmas that Michigan State has always had, because we've been about 5% of the graduating class, a little bit more. We grew as Michigan graduating class grew, but it's not recognized. It's not necessarily the financially most savvy way to behave by keeping those commitments. And we are turning away Michigan kids who could do very well here.
Here, MSU President Simon explains what to her are the new realities facing higher education.
Well, I think that if you look at the automobile industry, if you look at global competition, you look at the cyclical nature we always thought about the automobile industry. I think the automobile industry in Michigan had to undergo a real fundamental change, because we are no longer in the up and down cycle of good and bad that you can simply weather by hunkering down and then continuing to do what you've always done. And I think that those are realities as well for universities. And so we've made sort of fundamental adjustments in our cost structure, with great support from our faculty, staff, and students. It's the cumulative effect of a year of zero salary increase. It's a cumulative effect of controlling the university's share of healthcare cost increases to 5%. It's a cumulative effect that will be felt on eliminating post-retirement benefits for all new employees, because that will play out very positively over a period of time. And there are lots of other changes that we're continuing to make to streamline the operation of the university, but recognizing that we're probably not in a period where there's going to be a dramatic rebound of support, but hopefully it will get stronger, but it's hard to say that we can recover what we've lost over the last 10 years. If you think about the early 80s, which was the other huge automobile downturn in Michigan and impacted the university enormously, under President Mackey and Provost Winder, where they made dramatic programmatic recommendations. 2 years later, the appropriation was actually much higher and covered inflation plus, got back all the money. That's just not going to happen again. The same is going to be true with the federal budget. We think, that we can be very competitive. It's just going to be the numbers are not going to grow the way they have. I'm not sure that's great for the country because I think we're going to lose global competitiveness. And then in addition, that new reality is that, while the United States seems to be backing away from support of great public universities in many dimensions, almost every other country in the world has decided that that's the key to their future. And they're investing very, very heavily in research. We had this week alone, we've had visitors from Turkey who see using their prosperity to grow dramatically the number of students both studying abroad but also attending college. And they want to partner on a number of very sophisticated research projects that they think will rebound positively to them, including some things they're doing with Ford and Dow in Turkey that have research implications, not simply manufacturing implications. Then there was a visitor as well, a set of visitors from Korea, because they're going to build a gigantic research park, investing at least $1 billion, if not more, in the short term to create the research expertise that they think the United States has that will give them a competitive advantage in very, very fundamental areas, not in applied areas. You look at the visit from India that will also occur this week on their plans on dramatically growing the number of people who have public education, but also taking a small number of institutions and making them world-class in research by enormous investments in dollars. Or you look at the CAST, King Abdullah Science and Technology Institutes in Saudi Arabia, one of U.S. partners, and you see what they're trying to do in fundamental research, not applied research, but fundamental research. And the list sort of goes on and on. And so that sort of benefit that Americans have taken for granted that has come out of the innovation cycle of its universities is being copied. And in the same way people have copied manufacturing, and we lost an enormous amount as a country. You've got to worry a lot about the future if we don't recognize that it's just not about what we can spend today or solve a today problem, but this is really critical to the future of the country and its competitiveness.
MSU President Luana Simon talks about the latest buzzword in higher ed, the globally engaged university.
Well, I think that in order to understand what's happening around the world, you've got to have a sense of the context. And there's no better way to have a sense of context than to be a part of that world. If we want Michigan to be one of the enormous hubs for food innovation, food export, we got to understand the rest of the world. You can't do that in isolation anymore. And that requires that you be genuinely globally engaged. It also means that because of supply chains and the way in which commerce is occurring around the globe, not just IT issues, but commerce in general, that we're in a very good position to try to knit together our partner institutions from Asia, from Africa, from South America around some of these global supply chain issues, counterfeiting, food safety, drug safety, the kinds of things that can wreak havoc because something starts in one place in the world and ends up in another. And that's why you need to be globally engaged in order to be able to be a part of understanding that as well as a part of the solution that then rebounds positively back home.
MSU President Luana Simon describes MSU's brand.
Well, I think that if you look at a place like Michigan State, that we've always been committed to advancing knowledge and transforming lives. And the only way you do that is with world-class scholarship. That people from whatever backgrounds deserve the best in order that they compete against the best. And so that's really at the essence of who we are and what we're about. And that requires, you know, this capacity for world-class scholarship. It requires a capacity for education, for great competence, but also relevance. And it requires connections to our various stakeholders in ways that we're just not throwing knowledge over the transom, but we're generally working so that we can change the prosperity index.
MSU President Simon reflects on a prosperous, just completed winter athletics season at MSU.
Well, we want to sort of recognize the significant accomplishments of our many sports teams. Anytime you don't win a championship, there's a little bit of disappointment. But when you reflect on whether it's hockey or men's basketball, women's basketball, with the injuries that they had to key players at the beginning of the season, to get into the tournament was an accomplishment. For the men, they played very, very well. The accolades to Izzo and Green are well deserved, because they've won, because they represent the best values of college basketball.
For MSU Today, I'm Russ White. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises,
alumni.msu.edu.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Show me his milk.
Well, Michigan State University has one of the best turf grass teaching, research, and extension programs in the entire world. We're going to learn a bit more about that program and get some spring lawn care tips, especially helpful given the amazing temperature fluctuations we've been experiencing this spring. I'm pleased to welcome back to the show turf grass expert Kevin Frank. Kevin's an associate professor in the Department of Crop and Soil Sciences at Michigan State University. He's also an MSU Ag Bio Research Scientist. Kevin, great to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Speaking of the world-class turf grass program, you recently returned from China, where you were over there, I believe, for 3 weeks. Quite a nice program going over there.
Yeah, we've had a joint teaching program over there with four Chinese universities since 2006 was the first year we went over there. Continue to do it. It's always an interesting trip, different side of the world, a little bit different climate than we have here sometimes, but interesting to see what's going on over there.
Yes, we've talked about this before, but for the listeners who may not have heard an earlier interview, what is the status of the turf grass industry in China, and is golf really catching on over there, for example?
It's always changing. It's a little unpredictable. Golf has been something that has surged, and then last fall, I think it was last fall or late last summer, the central government basically put a stop on all new golf course construction. So everything ground to a halt and is still kind of in a holding pattern over there. So there's a lot of activity, a lot of people hoping their new golf courses that they're trying to build will get approved and get going this year. Because if you look at, like, compared to the States even, I see more golf course architects in China than anywhere, because that's potential jobs for them. There's not a lot of new construction in the States for golf courses. But it's interesting because it's not the same system we have here.
Do you have any idea what the rationale was for the government to slow down the construction of golf courses in China?
Well, there's always politics, and golf is certainly a luxury elite sport in China. It's, you know, I will tell people there that, you know, I grew up playing on municipal golf courses, and I can find a number of golf courses throughout Michigan that, you know, you could go play 18 holes with a cart for probably $20, $25, and they just hear that, and they can't even believe it, because although many of their courses you can play, they cost you about what maybe it costs you to go play Pebble Beach, you know, $300, $500, U.S. dollars. Which is very expensive for the average Chinese to go play. So I think there was some of that consideration. And also probably trying to get a handle on projects as far as do they have proper permitting, approval for the land that they were buying or negotiating from the farmers to use.
And so they put a temporary hold. And when they're building these golf courses in China, are they doing like we're doing here in the States and being very environmentally conscious about these golf courses? Are they looking at all the different variables that we're looking at?
There's certainly those that are doing it correctly and are environmentally conscious or looking at things as they construct and post-construction. But there's always that concern of, is there somebody that's just, you know, kind of plowing through everything, not going through the proper permitting process. I think that was part of why the government over there put a stop on things.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's switch over to the United States, Kevin. I'll ask you the same question. Then we'll get into some of mm-hmm. these spring lawn care tips. But in terms of environmental consciousness, in the time that you've been involved in working with turfgrass and you've been advising golf course managers and designers, et cetera, what are the biggest changes you've seen in terms of the sustainability of golf courses?
I think some of the biggest things is just the technology we use today. Irrigation, for example, most golf courses not only have computers that control their irrigation system, just like everything in the world, you can do it from your phone now. They put in moisture sensors in their putting greens, and you can check those through an app on your phone wherever you're at and say, okay,
that's awesome.
The 15th green is drying down. We might need to put a little more water on tonight. And literally the superintendent could do that sitting on their couch at home and at 8 o'clock at night if they wanted to make that adjustment and change. So those types of technologies, I think, are going to continue to advance the golf industry and environmental stewardship for not only water. There's a lot of activity now with very site-specific applications of being able to sense as you go across a fairway, for example, if there's different diseases occurring, only spot spray those areas. You know, fertility applications, the same thing is coming down the line. So I think a lot of those advancements, and then just the overall understanding that golf courses are trying to do the right thing and trying to really be stewards of the environment. And I think if I could add just one other thing, one thing that is really striking to me when you look at, and part of this is some of the experience I've had in China, when you look at our society today and we're becoming more and more urban, and you look at green space, and as you fly into some cities, sometimes the only green space you see or large green spaces, golf courses.
Yeah.
And those become habitat environments for a lot of wildlife and a lot of birds. So I think that perspective has really changed from probably what it was, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective that I hadn't thought about. My guest is Kevin Frank, who's an associate professor in the Department of Crop and Soil Sciences at Michigan State, also a turf grass expert. Kevin, I don't need to tell you about the anomalies in the weather that we've had this spring. It got really warm, then it got cool again, and who knows where it's going next. What does this mean for the average homeowner who would typically be out, well, maybe not even be out yet, working in the yard?
Yeah, if you didn't get out yet, you've missed a lot of activity already. As we were chatting earlier, you know, many of us, this is the first time we can remember mowing in March. And so, you know, if you weren't out there getting these things done, you're behind the ball a little bit. Now, one thing that I think we really need to address is crabgrass prevention. This is typically the first application a lot of homeowners might make to their lawns is a fertilizer with a pre-emergence herbicide that controls crabgrass. Typically, if you look at everything we've written and we talk about, we'll tell you almost every year in Michigan, somewhere between April 15th and May 1st. This year, that was March 15th.
Right.
So, I mean, literally, you've missed it. Mm-hmm. So there's still an opportunity for you, but you need to look for a specific product. And the product you need to look for, you're going to have to get into the fine print of the bag now, mm-hmm. and you look for a product that's called Dimension. That's the herbicide. Right. The actual active ingredient is a little more complicated. It's called dithiopyr, which is a spelling exercise for most of us. But look for Dimension, because that will provide you some what we call early post activity. So we're late already because we've had this freak March weather. If the crabgrass is actually starting to come up, which it shouldn't be yet, you know, we've cooled down a little bit, we're bouncing around now, but that will provide you some activity on the early stuff that's already germinating for crabgrass and then cover any that would be coming later. So in many respects, that might be almost your best approach this year, because as early as March came and those high temperatures, that's really going to lengthen out potentially that window of when crabgrass is going to germinate into the summer. And it's possible, and I think this is going to be a challenge for a lot of the professional applicators that had to get out there early, of what they're going to have to follow up with later, or are they going to struggle with crabgrass breakthrough coming later in the summer and then make some applications to try to control that. So there's still hope, but just look for a specific product Dimension on the bag.
So a major issue with crabgrass control, what about other weeds? What about dandelions and things of that nature? Would that be basically same old, same old?
Everything's coming up early. I mean, and that's the thing that's confusing, because if you look at those temperatures, I mean, I was out of the country, and I'm looking back, and I couldn't believe it, you know, 80s. And you had this two-week period where everything really went high. Then it started to come back a little bit. So it's kind of like, I don't know that we know. I mean, you know, everything's going to be a little bit different. So I think you're just really going to have to keep an eye out. You know, it comes to something like dandelions. What we usually tell people is you see that first flush, you see all the you know, the brilliant yellow color out there. A lot of times the best time to treat those is actually wait till they'll usually go to the puffball stage, then they'll rebloom. Treat them on kind of like that second flush of yellow you see. That's a little bit more effective at trying to burn them down this time of the year. Best time to always do it is fall. I mean, if you can do fall applications, mm-hmm. you never see the problem in the spring. But
yeah, you've mentioned before that fall is a time when a lot of homeowners don't think that they should be out there, but could be the best preventative time the whole year.
Yeah, it's just hard to tell people right now, hey, wait till October. Because
right.
everybody's got that green energy right now to go out there and do something, because even though we had a mild winter, everybody still wants to get outside.
What about with respect to mowing and the other things? Pretty much the normal course of action?
Yeah, just keep up on mowing. You know, we had the big growth flush in March. Obviously, things are off to a roaring start. Just make sure you don't get too far behind on mowing. Probably another thing to mention, too, is just fertilizer applications. I think that's a big key even for any weed issue, whether it's crabgrass or dandelions. If you've got dense turf, you don't usually have crabgrass. Mm-hmm. It's usually you have to have voids. You have to have a thinning turf stand to have those weeds compete. So a lot of times I'll tell people, even with crabgrass, you know, look at what your turf looks like. You know, you don't necessarily have to apply a pre-emergence if you know you don't have a problem.
And, Kevin, we always like to mention this, but there are lots of educational items that people can go online and find at Lawn Care University, at Michigan State University. How do people get to the website?
Yeah, probably the best thing to do is just our general turf website, which is just www.turf.msu.edu. look on the home lawn section. There's also a golf course section, athletic fields. But that will link you to, we have some resources for identifying weeds. That's another website, but you can link through there. We have one on diseases now. They're very helpful, kind of hands-on type. Hey, if you know what it looks like, try to match up a picture. We can give you some recommendations to try to control it.
Excellent. Another service of Michigan State University to the as part of our land-grant tradition.
Yes, absolutely.
I've been talking with Kevin Frank. He's a turf grass expert at Michigan State University. He's also, his work is supported by our good friend and sponsor, MSU Ag Bio Research. Kevin, welcome back from China, and thanks again for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com. Can you dig it, baby? You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, one of the things we want listeners to know is how connected we are, that we're in a response mode of addressing real life problems in the real world here in Michigan.
Dr. Steve Pepke leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
Well, we're everywhere. We're the face of MSU across the state, in the local communities, with infrastructure and research expertise to address those local problems. MSU Ag Bioresearch is the research engine that undergirds the food and agricultural industry in the state, that undergirds our natural resource usage, recreational usages of sport, fishing, forestry, all of those things. And of course, with the recent interest in renewable energy, we have in a very big way moved into this arena as well.
MSU Ag Bioresearch.
Green, green, it's green, they say. On the far side of the hill. Green, green, I'm going away to where the grass is greener still.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's always a pleasure to welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes Wayne Wood, who is the president of the Michigan Farm Bureau. Michigan Farm Bureau is the state's largest general farm organization, representing more than 47,000 wonderful Michigan farm families, including my own. Oh, Wayne, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for your membership. We appreciate it.
It's always good to see you, but especially this time of the year. It's spring. We have an early spring this year. As you look forward to 2012, is agriculture going to continue to be the great story that it's been for the last several years?
Agriculture will continue to thrive as it did through the downturn in Michigan economy. It continued to be stable or improve. I don't think we're going to see the commodity prices because, as you know, farmers have the ability to produce themselves out of a good price every time they get it. That will not change. We respond well to the market. But I think there are some pretty positive things happening out there, and that is that there was a lot of investments made from last year's cash flow. And so that's very positive for the industry. There's a renewed awareness of the need for processing in Michigan, and that can only add value and jobs to Michigan. So there's several positive things. Yes, it's an early spring. we're still going to have a little winter weather. We might as well face it. We're still going to see a snowflake. It would be really weird if we don't. The fruit folks are on pins and needles of what's going to happen there.
And understandably so.
Yes. And we're getting reports in that maybe New York State took a real hit in the apple industry. Hopefully ours made it through. We were blessed a few nights ago, and it didn't get quite as cold along the ridge that we thought it was going to. So agriculture has a resiliency that just from time to time looks unbelievable. But farmers always have two good years, 1974 and next year.
Wayne, I've heard rumors that some of the sugar beet folks have already have done some planting, and that there are some intrepid folks out there who are going to get an early start this year. Are you hearing the same thing?
I've witnessed it. There's a lot of sugar beets in the ground. In fact, there's corn and soybeans planted in the thumb. People, just to see if the planter's working.
Yeah, right.
Also known as, I can go to the coffee shop tomorrow morning and say I got some corn planted.
So you're the big man at the coffee shop that morning, right?
Not me. I'm not Will.
No, I know.
But there are.
Well, the stories have been good, and I've also heard reports that there have been issues around the world that are going to affect, and maybe in a positive way, our corn and soybeans this year, particularly the soybeans, because there are other parts of the world that have had some issues already.
That's right. Other parts of the world have some issues. The world economy has a huge effect, and whether we can keep up the level of exports that we've had. It's sad to see that somebody has to suffer for you to be successful, but it's great to recognize that Michigan and American agriculture continue to feed the world and continue to produce high-quality food for the world. So it provides an opportunity for us.
Wayne, you mentioned that because of the recent good years, some farmers have made some really good investments with some of the cash flow that they've realized, particularly some of the cash crop farmers. What are those investments? Are they buying more land, more equipment? Are they paying down debt? What are they doing?
Well, what I see is they're paying down debt. They're putting in a lot of tile in our area, which only increases productivity. And then they're able to adopt more technology that's more site-specific as they farm, so it makes better use of the fertilizer, et cetera, that they are putting out.
My guest is Wayne Wood, who's the president of the Michigan Farm Bureau. Wayne, some of this new technology you just mentioned, we think maybe wind farms and solar panels and methane digesters. Where are Michigan farmers when it comes to alternative energy, creating it and using it?
They're basically right where you would expect farmers to be. They're very independent. The wind energy is good if the windmill's on my farm. If it's not on my farm, maybe it's not. Mm-hmm. But they're very supportive of that. They recognize that they play a key role in our society as we move to more of that type of energy generation. Methane digesters, I would say the broad spectrum of farmers are hoping that they become more affordable for smaller livestock operations, and I know that research is going on, because let's face it, we don't like $4 gas any better than anybody else. We don't like the high cost of diesel.
Particularly diesel, yes.
That's what we use a lot of, and you know, if we can find an alternative power source, we're going to. It's amazing as you drive through the countryside, the number of farms that got solar panels up. That is really shocking.
Well, shocking in some ways, but again, back to innovative agriculture. Agriculture's always been innovative, looking at new ideas.
Quietly innovative.
Quietly innovative. We had your friend Cliff Musin on about 2 weeks ago talking about some of the things they've done at Zeeland Farm Services.
Yeah.
And they've even got a LEED certified headquarters building, and they use landfill gas to power their whole operation. I mean, it's amazing.
It's just, you know, I mentioned quietly a minute ago, and I think that that pretty well summarizes agriculture. We're just going to go about it. We're just going to do our business. Just don't try and overregulate us, because that's when you're stepping on our feet then.
Let's get right into some of your strategic priorities at Michigan Farm Bureau, just recently established. And I think it's important to say they're not established from the top down at Farm Bureau. These come up from the counties and become policy. But you have three priorities that you've established.
Well, we certainly do. That's become a method that we're using. These three priorities actually were established by a group of county presidents who took those three ideas and put some meat on the bones, an action plan of where we want to go. And, you know, those priorities then, as you pointed out, have the support of the grassroots, and that's where it needs to happen. It doesn't do our staff or our board any good if we don't have the people behind us. In an election year, everybody knows that.
Everybody knows that. Well, let's take them one at a time. The one that you mentioned just before the break, over-regulation, fighting regulations. It's not the Farm Bureau's against regulation. It's over-regulation, right, Wayne?
We support regulation as long as it's science-based, but we have a lot of regulations that are emotion-based, put in by folks who maybe don't understand our industry or maybe think they know a better way that we should do it, some of these things. A great example is the Department of Labor in their child labor law, and you know very well from your career that there's a great work ethic developed among those farm kids because they have to. And so the ability to not be able to work on your parents' farm because it's a partnership is simply not logical. I just reflect to those folks that one of the greatest opportunities I had in life was to grow up next door to my grandfather. And, you know, I tell folks that as you get in your teenage years, your parents don't know anything, but your grandfather's the smartest one in the world.
Absolutely.
So you go and pick your grandfather's brain, and I look back on that, and boy, he had a lot of influence on my values. And that, taking that opportunity away to work side by side in a family operation is certainly disturbing.
Well, that effort to put limitations on the age when kids can work on the farm, you headed that off, right, if I recall?
Well, they're reconsidering.
Mm-hmm.
This was put in so that migrant families wouldn't take their family to the orchard or to the blueberry patch or whatever. And you know that segment of society is even more closely knit as a family.
Absolutely.
But we cast a net and caught everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is sometimes what Washington does.
Yes. Yes, it happens well inside the Beltway.
Well, let's take a look at it from the state level. It's no secret that Governor Snyder was supportive of agriculture during his campaign, and from the first day he took office, he recognized in his speech the importance of agriculture. But he's doing some things in Michigan to reduce regulations, if I'm not mistaken.
He certainly is, and we appreciate it. Granted, we're seeking more, because there are still some things out there, but the ag friendliness of our governor, our administration, and the folks that he's put in place, in my opinion, as far as I can recall, has never been better. Governor Snyder is a quick study. He recognized that agriculture has the opportunity to underpin Michigan's economy, and he's thrown out a challenge to us. He's thrown out a challenge of getting to $100 billion economic impact, and you watch the middle of April, we've made big progress on this. There's an announcement coming.
Well, he's thrown out challenges across the board. I mean, he's got that dashboard of success.
Yep.
That he expects everybody to post on.
Yep, and agriculture was very happy to step up and do their part.
We've talked a little bit about the regulations. Let's get to the market access, local foods, transportation, infrastructure. What are the issues?
Well, the issues with the market access are, of course, exports. We are very dependent on exports here in Michigan. At least 30% of our product goes to exports. We are very dependent on a system of moving our commodities, whether it be to a grain elevator or to a processing plant or whatever. We need a good infrastructure. And quite frankly, the bridge, we are very supportive of the bridge. I indicated we exported 60% or 30% of what we produce. 60% of that goes to Canada. They are a huge customer of ours. And so we need to be able to move that stuff across the bridge as quickly as possible. It is a bit concerning when we have truckers that say, I'll be at the bridge for 3 or 4 hours,
right,
and then I got to drive through downtown Windsor to get out to get to my place. That's a bit concerning, and we need to make that flow easier, and, of course, Canadians have stepped up. But there's also another question here, and that is, will we see some improvement in the rail? Because we can move so much more stuff with rail. And can we produce enough to attract the rail companies to expand? We think with the right incentives that we can do something like that. We've seen rail drop off. Of course, our ultimate goal would be to transport processed goods out of the state, right, rather than raw materials.
But we need to ramp up our processing capability.
We need to ramp up our processing.
And we've been talking about that for a long time.
We have, and the governor's put things in place to try and attract some of those people. But I understand those concerns of those companies, because if they come in here and make a multi-million dollar investment, they need some stability as far as the environmental issues, as far as what we're going to have here for things such as work comp and health insurance and those things before they want to make that. But the interesting question that I get is, can you guarantee a supply?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer is, can you guarantee you'll pay?
You do represent farm families, Wayne. Let's move quickly into a secure workforce, because that has been a problem not only in Michigan, but across the United States. Frame that issue.
Okay. Your mind immediately jumps to the transient workforce, because we use 45,000 transient workers a year here in Michigan to harvest mainly vegetables and fruit. However, there's a huge workforce that's in the dairy industry that's not transient but comes from the same source offshore. Now, what I want to do is get people to think about the fact that we need some technical folks moving into agriculture. Earlier, we had a little discussion here about the technology that's in agriculture, and we're very concerned that we don't have adequate folks, whether they're coming out of Michigan State or where they're coming out of, that have the technology to that understanding that agriculture is adopting to take over. If you've heard the governor talk about it, in excess of 50% of the administrative level of agriculture is going to retire within the next 5 years. And I'm not going to be a naysayer, but we need some of those people to pop up pretty quick,
yes,
that are going to take those positions over. So is it a 4-year degree? Some cases. But it might be just a 2-year degree. We might be able to do a lot of things with a 2-year degree.
Or it might be a certificate program at a community,
yes,
college or a 4-year school.
Yeah. But we need that expertise in agriculture. Everybody thinks it's, oh, you just want to hire people to pick stones and you want to pay them minimum wage. Let me assure you, there's very few. In fact, I know of none in agriculture that are working for minimum wage. A lot of them are making much more money than
much
you do at a
money.
Fast food store or anything like that.
Wayne, we've got about a minute left. Real quickly, are we going to get a farm bill passed this year?
I'm not betting any money on that. If it is, it'll be in lame duck. I think that the Senate will turn one out late April, early May. But the House is the House debate right now is whether we extend this one for another year or whether we try to do it. And I'm guessing we're down to probably about 52 legislative days left. That's a pretty quick farm bill.
So if you're a betting man, you're looking at an extension.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Wayne, best of luck moving forward this year. By the way, I will mention in Ingham County, we had a Rural Education Day just a few days ago. It was a fabulous success. There were over 1,000 young people, third and fourth graders, who came just learning about agriculture and what a wonderful profession and industry that it is.
And you think about that and the opportunity those kids go home and they tell their parents, they tell the rest of their family about the exciting day they had. What a great avenue for agriculture to educate our society on some of the practices that we use.
And on that very positive note, Wayne, thanks so much for being on Greening the Great Lakes. It's always great to see you.
Thank you for the opportunity. I do hope we get a farm bill done this year, but I'm not holding out for it.
I've been talking with Wayne Wood, who's the president of the Michigan Farm Bureau.
Everybody, I want to hear it now.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to a half a million Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
We're the face of MSU across the state, with infrastructure and research expertise to address those local problems.
Dr. Steve Pepke leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
MSU Ag Bio Research is the research engine that undergirds the food and agricultural industry in the state.
MSU Ag Bio Research.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.